spot. Okay, sir. Coming right up.
Tune in to hear something classic or something fresh. Tuesdays at 10 a.m. on CFRC.
Hey, Charlie, table 26 wants a hot alphabet soup.
G'day and welcome to a Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's and other Ontario universities every now and then. My name is CJ the DJ and I'm your host for this week's Grad Chat. Of course, a show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs as well as CFRC. So thank you very much to both of them. Now, if you may miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify and CFRC Podcasts. So no excuse not to hear what our awesome students and postdoctoral fellows are doing. Today, though, I am very excited to introduce you to David McFarlane, who is doing a PhD in Media and Design at Toronto Metropolitan University under the supervision of Dr. Alexandra Ball. Welcome to Grad Chat, David.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Well, as you, I mean, you may not know, but I have interviewed a couple of others from the Lake Shift Writing Retreat, which, as a recap for everyone, that's where Queen's invites other doctoral students in Ontario at Ontario universities to come and join us on a writing retreat up at Queen's University Biology Station. And David was lucky to get one of those spots this year. And it was actually great having David there because he's a bit of a canoeist, which we'll find a little bit more about later. And part of the writing is also a chance to relax a little bit. So David found himself teaching a lot of people how to canoe, which we were very thankful for, of course. So with the Lake Shift, though, David, just to sort of get a little bit more into that, how did you find, first of all, why did you want to come to the Lake Shift and what did you personally get from it, hopefully with some writing done in there?
just to circle back on your comment about teaching people how to canoe, it was so much fun sharing the canoeing experience with people that have never been in a canoe before. It was so delightful just to see the joy.
It is good, isn't it?
Yeah, it was terrific.
Yeah, because we've had a lot of students who have come, have never been out of the city, or as you said, come from other countries and things and never had these sorts of experience that Canadians kind of expect to have.
Yeah, it was delightful just seeing them, just almost like a childish kind of joy. It was super fun.
Well, I think I like the fact, so I'm going to interrupt there. I like the fact at the end of camp, everyone signed your canoe.
Yes.
Which was pretty awesome.
I was paddling around the south shore of Lake Superior with my wife just a couple of weeks ago, and we were looking at the notes in the canoe, and I just felt the energy and the support of all the kind souls that I met at Lake Shift who signed my canoe.
That's
so
brilliant.
I'm grateful for that. I was kind of voluntold about Lake Shift. I didn't know anything about it, and our dean sent a note asking if I would be interested in going to Lake Shift, and I thought, wow, this is a terrific opportunity. The director of my program, he suggested my name to her. He put forward my name based on the fact that my research involves water and being out on a lake. So he thought it was a perfect fit. And indeed, it was really a great opportunity for me to, you know, besides all of the writing workshops and the community building, it was great just to be on a lake in a canoe with all my gear, just sort of debugging and working through some of those technical challenges, which are hard to do in the city. So it was terrific.
Well, I think you were quite lucky because you do work with water and things. We'll hear a little bit more about that. And as you said, you did have some equipment, which everyone found fascinating anyway. But not many people come and sort of do a bit of their field research, so to speak, while they're there. But clearly you had an opportunity to do that, which is great.
Yeah, and I felt knowing that there were other biologists and people kind of working and doing hands-on fieldwork research made it, I guess, kind of a safe place for me to do that. I didn't feel like some weird performance artist out, you know, on the water. I felt more like, oh yeah, I'm a researcher. This is research. I'm doing my fieldwork. So,
and I think the young researchers that were there during summer to do the work on various labs and things that were there, not within our group, but there all summer. I think they found it fascinating too. So thank you for sort of showing them what you were doing too, because it gives them more ideas as well. I mean, these were, a lot of them were undergrads, and gave them an idea of, you know, I could be thinking things in a different way to what we normally see.
Yeah, it was super fun interacting with them. Their enthusiasm and their excitement was infectious. So it was great.
So with the, I guess we should sort of talk about your work. Now, your research, as you mentioned, explores how we might come to understand the Great Lakes as animated actors in their own rights with their own unique subjectivities. But it's a lot more than that. I mean, when I heard you sort of talking about, you know, you've got bits of equipment to take sound of the water and plants and things, like, oh my God, where's this person going? Anyway, but the point there is, of course, research comes in all different formats. And that's the nice thing these days, that you can do research in different ways, and you can write things up in different ways and collect things in different ways to what we traditionally knew about doing a PhD. So tell us a little bit more about your research topic, you know, the philosophical framework of it, and then a bit more about your research creation, just a bit of an overview there to start with.
It's probably a good setup to describe my degree program a little bit. It's unique. It's only in its fourth year, so I'm in the first cohort. It's called Media and Design Innovation at Toronto Metropolitan University, and it was sort of positioned to me as an opportunity to pursue alternative storytelling methodologies.
Right.
And it's what's known as a practice-based degree, which means that there is a practice component in addition to the traditional research prose written component. So all of my colleagues are practicing some way, shape, or form a media expertise or an art practice. There's a bead working artist in my cohort. There's a person who does walking tours as a means of oral storytelling. So the key is that there's a practice element, and that is seen to be on equal standing as research. So the research comes about sometimes by the doing.
Yes.
As opposed to just writing about it.
The practical side is good, or more of the storytelling, because we don't do enough storytelling when we get to the research.
Yeah. So my project in particular is, I conceived of it as a kind of a script, really. About 25 years ago, I had this idea of a story, of a narrative, either like a film script or a novel, or it seemed like a grand story. And the premise was, if each of the lakes were a character and could talk to each other and talk to us about what they've witnessed and seen and experienced, what would they say? And what would they teach us? What could we learn? And, you know, the plot, the story arc goes like the Great Lakes come into confluence at the end of the story. Somehow they come together. So I always had in mind this kind of coming together, this community, which I really liked, but the journey to get there is kind of bumpy and rocky and long and arduous and grand. So the idea never went away. It just, I never really found the right way to give it shape. I'm a visual artist and a musician. My visual art practice is more conceptual idea-based work. So this sort of fit in as a kind of giant concept. And I always sort of thrive on projects. I always know I'm onto something when I create a monster project that I know I'll never be able to finish. It sort of gives me like a freedom to play, where I can kind of chase down, you know, tangents of that larger idea. And I always wind up with really great results doing so. So this idea fit the bill, but it was kind of too grand in a way. And it didn't have kind of structure to it to help propel me along. So when I saw an advertisement for this degree in a mailing list, and I just read it, and it sounded like me, the description of the degree. So I read it to my wife, and she said, "That sounds like you." I read it to my mom, same thing. So I thought, well, geez.
Meant to be.
It kind of felt just like the fit was there. It was like...
The stars aligned.
Yeah, it really did. So I talked to a couple of the faculty members before I even applied, and I told them about my idea, and two of them said, yeah, I think it would be a really great fit. I'd work with you. So that's how it kind of started. It started really as finding a home for this idea to flourish.
Right.
So I was accepted in the first cohort, and you know, the idea transformed from trying to represent or personify the lakes very quickly into the area of sound and sonification, and what kinds of things can I learn about the lakes through sound, through listening.
Would you say you're a conservationist or environmentalist or anything like that, or you just have a love of the water and you want to protect it?
I think it's the latter. I mean, there is certainly an ecological, environmental area or aspect to the project that I wish to elevate and raise awareness about. But I do really just care about them and have been fascinated with them my whole life. I can remember going across, you know, large bridges into the United States and, you know, looking for the red line on the water dividing the U.S. from Canada. Like, I think I was born a conceptual artist. And
is there a red line?
No, there isn't. No. But actually, my wife and I had the experience just this couple weeks ago. We were paddling under the bridge in Mackinac through the straits, and at one point she was in Lake Michigan and I was in Lake Huron. So
right.
To me, that was
did you have a passport? That's what I want to know.
No, we don't need a passport.
Okay.
No, we were in Michigan at that point, so we had already crossed over the...
That's funny. So tell us a bit more about the method that you're using, because you keep talking about, I mean, you said you're a musician and things, but you're talking about using sound.
Yes.
And when I envisage water, it's the sound of water going over a waterfall or the waves crashing on a beach.
Yeah.
That's the kind of sound that I signify with water. What do you mean by trying to capture sound or what the water is telling us?
Well, I'm using several pieces of technology to help listen to the water. I've got some field recording, like a microphone, a stereo microphone with a little digital recorder that allows me to listen to the soundscape above the water. And the soundscape includes everything, birds, machines, humans, you know, the sounds that you mentioned about water, just whatever is in that particular soundscape is all welcome in terms of what, you know, I'm interested in listening to. So I'm not after a puritanical kind of recording of, you know, the water. It's really just whatever is in that soundscape that I can learn from and witness. And then sometimes I use a hydrophone, which is a microphone that goes under the water. Sometimes there are interesting sounds, whether there's currents or there's industrial noises, or, you know, if there's a bridge nearby, you'll hear cars, but through the water. You'll hear it through the water. And then I have a contact microphone on the canoe that sometimes turns the canoe into a microphone, essentially. So it picks up, you know, interactions between the water and the canoe and the people in the canoe, myself and my partner. And then I have probably the one that gets the most interest is a biodata sonification device. And it is, it's a fancy name. Someone needs to come up with a clever, shorter acronym for this thing. But it's really just a very simple device that it measures the microconductivity or changes in microconductivity on the surface of, say, like a plant leaf.
And, right.
And you probably saw me at Lake Shift. I had attached it to a plant that was just growing right by the picnic tables there outside. And it was sending these signals to this little small box that sonifies those impulses. And it basically turns them into MIDI data, which is a language that musical instruments use. It was very popular in the 80s. It still is very popular. So those impulses from the plant are turned into notes through MIDI. And that's what you were listening to.
And so for everyone, it created kind of like a song, really, or music. To listen to, and I guess you could put, in that little box, could you say if it's at this level, it's going to be this kind of noise, and at this level, it's going to be this other sort of noise? Is that how it works, or?
It, what it does is it maps the impulses or the emissions, the electrical emissions from the plant. It maps them onto a scale. So in the in the case of what you were listening to, it was mapped to a chromatic scale, which is this simple 12-note scale. And there are other scales that I can decide which are mapped to. And I also assign a MIDI a voicing, so a synthesized voice. You were listening to, I believe I had you know, some basic synthesizer sounds. So it's not the plant deciding any of that stuff. It's
the machine.
It's myself assigning the scale and the voicing, but what the plant is doing, it can influence things like pitch, so which note is being selected, you know, velocity, attack, sustain. So there are a number of things that will influence, or there are some parameters, musical parameters, that the plant is determining.
Right. But are you, I mean, that's not a plant, but you want to talk more about water.
Yeah.
So can that be used in the water?
I've been experimenting with ways to do it, and it's quite challenging. So what I have been doing, and I was going pretty far down that road of trying to develop or adapt the technology. And it was, after a while, and speaking with my committee, we all felt that it was a distraction. It was taking me off the sort of main direction. So what I've been doing is using that technology on plants that are growing right beside the water, or in some cases, out of the water. So the plants are helping mediate some of the information in the water. You could suppose that.
Yeah, I like that word, suppose.
Yeah.
So I, reading some of your publications and things, you've also brought into your work a lot about Indigenous knowledge. Where did that come from? And was that just a natural thing, just the way you've been brought up, is to look at traditional ways of knowing? Because let's face it, they've looked after these lands for a very, very long time, the lands and the water for a very long time, and being keepers sort of to help. Is that where your fascination and the lean of your research has come from, or has it just had an influence?
Well, I think you touched right on the key piece there, which is that the Indigenous peoples have been the stewards of the land for thousands of years, and who better to learn from than them in terms of how to be a good visitor and a good listener. So I look to that scholarship for those sorts of insights. Mm-hmm. And I think also, you know, being exposed to canoeing and canoe tripping and being on the land, being on the water, most of my young adult life, you know, in the role of camping and canoe tripping, I just really felt an affinity to being on the water, using those tools and technologies which have been given to us by Indigenous peoples. So it was always sort of there, just to have an awareness of and a respect for Indigenous ways of knowing and being. And I'm very fortunate to be encouraged by my committee and to be friends with and engaged with Indigenous scholars who have been very generous in sharing their insights with me and very supportive of my research.
So what do they think of how you're going about your research? I mean, because you mentioned other things too, sustainable collaboration between people and nature, and you bring in the dish with one spoon, one palm, etc. So, you know, having the opportunity to speak with some Indigenous elders and other community members, how are they actually perceiving what you're doing?
Well, I'm not sure if I can speak for them about how they're perceiving it, but I've felt support. I have felt encouragement and support and insight in how to, you know, be a better visitor. And really that's kind of at the crux of it, I think. It's how do you go out onto the land that may not want you there? So how do you know whether you're welcome or not? So, you know, aspects of ceremony and reciprocity come into play. How I behave on the water, what I bring with me, the paints that I use, the chemicals that I don't include in those paints, like all of those, concerns kind of give me a bit of an ethical framework to approach my research through. So I've been trying really hard. The first part of my degree was a lot of foundational reading around, you know, best practices, what one would call that in a more professional space, but really it's how to behave ethically and how to try to, you know, make yourself a better listener and a better visitor, because we are visitors to those spaces. So that's what I've been trying to think about and write about adjacent to all of this other activity. So
I think you brought up a good word there, listener. I mean, what you're doing is recording sounds and things that are going on. So you're listening to how the lakes are behaving.
Yeah, I think.
And, you know, if it's a big storm, maybe underneath that water, a lot more is going on because there's a storm. That's a natural thing, a storm. But if there's buildings going on, a lot of drilling and things, that's not so natural.
Right.
In the thing. So, you know, how does that play differently in the water? How would they feel? It's going to sound, people are going to think I'm a bit bonkers, but how does that make the water feel knowing that this construction is happening right next door to me? How's that going to impact my shoreline?
Yeah.
Because even with motorboats, you go on a canoe, much less disturbance in the water than if someone's in a motorboat.
Yeah, a canoe is a terrific marriage of form and function. It really is an exquisite design. It's so elegant how it behaves and how it forces you as a paddler to adapt your body to the shape of the canoe. And it really kind of tunes you to the water. You have to behave a certain way in a canoe to be able to survive on the water. So it forces you to consider the embodied experience of being on the water. And I think, you know, that's a great teaching just right in and of itself, just being in a canoe on the water. It calms you. It makes you really focus on what you're doing. And that's a shift, right? That's a shift that we take for granted, but it's really profound, especially when you're out on a very, very large lake like Superior, you know, where you really are at the mercy of the water. At any given time, things can change, and you know, it has a reputation for having some pretty serious weather that can spring up very all of a sudden. So you really need to be paying attention. And when we go out on the water, we take a minute and we ask for gentle weather, basically, before we paddle, and it really puts us in tune with what we're doing. It heightens our awareness, or it helps encourage us to be more aware of what we're doing. Yeah.
So where are you in your research right now? Because I imagine in the beginning you must have had an idea of what you wanted to produce or find out. Where are you now, and where are you still? What do you still need to do to get to what you thought you were heading towards? It doesn't always turn out to be that way. Sometimes it changes along the way.
Oh, yeah. There's been a number of turns along the way. But what's been really helpful for me is to kind of return to my initial fascination, which was just this story. You know, I've gone down some rabbit holes where all of a sudden I'm doing biology, or all of a sudden I'm doing, you know, sociology or indigenous studies, or so I always return to that initial story to center myself and really just feel okay just being fascinated with the water. And, you know, I'm not a biologist, I'm an artist, I'm a musician, so, you know, some of the tools and techniques that I use take me into those realms, and they can kind of distract you a little bit. So I really return to that large story as a reminder that it's okay. It's okay to be an artist and to be looking to the lakes for inspiration and to be fascinated with them, to be in awe and wonder, to not know. So I try to celebrate those things too. And I'm at the point now where I am doing a lot of field work, and I'm really, the theory has been, you know, it's sort of in the background. It's off to the side, and it's not so important in my mind. I'm really reveling in just the experience of being on the water. I've been painting watercolors that are diaristic reflections of just how I'm feeling and how the water has made me feel. So, and I've also been doing a lot of recordings. So I haven't actually played back or reviewed much of the stuff I've gathered so far. So I'm in this really weird limbo state where I'm accumulating all of this documentation, which I know I'm going to go and interpret and probably add my own musical expression to and combine in various ways and sort of mix. And then at that point, I will be able to figure out how this thing is going to take shape. So right now I've given myself permission to not know or not
have, just to be creative
just to be as present as I can in the activity and celebrate accidents, coincidences, whatever you want to call it, things that happen when you put yourself as a creative person in that state of play. Some people call it a state of play. I'm not sure if it's play. It's playful, what I'm doing. But it's really, it's trying to be present and trying to be open to what's going on around me and to try to feel connected and related, is a word that comes up a lot.
So that's a natural thing that most doctoral students go through. The research part can be fascinating, but there comes a point when you have to stop. And then with all that data or research, however way you're collecting it, you've got to say, okay, at some stage, I want to get this degree. So what do I need to do to get to this degree? And you may have all these other ideas, but they're going to have to be put on the back burner.
Yes.
So how do you feel you're going to go about choosing out of all those recordings, for instance, and paintings and ideas, how you feel you're going to go to be able to bring it down enough to show the defense committee that you understand this area. This is a new exciting area of research, a new way of showcasing it. How are you going to choose?
Well, I think that it's pretty natural for an artist or artists to find themselves with all of that stuff and to try to make sense of it. I mean, every time you do an exhibition, you sort of go through that process.
True. You have to narrow down what goes in, what doesn't.
You have to narrow. And I think that's what artists and musicians do. They take complexity and they kind of give it a form and a shape and a size, if you will, that can be absorbed and understood and shared by others. So I don't worry too much about that. I know that's just sort of a natural kind of process that I know will happen. And I've seen clues like, oh yeah, that's a direction that I think is going to emerge. Like I've seen that kind of stuff. I do feel the pressure to, okay, I need to write about this. And writing is my second language. You know, I don't come to it first. I'm an okay writer, but it's a very slow and arduous process for me. It's definitely not my first instinct is to write about something. But, you know, it is rewarding to write about it in that you can zero in on areas and gain insights that will inform, you know, the next project or the next piece or the next aspect of this project. So I've been given those little gifts here and there from writing. So I know it has rewards there. So it is a worthwhile activity for sure for a creative person.
Are you going to create an audio piece as part of this? Yes.
I think there will be an exhibition of some kind where there will be audio components, there will be visual components. Visuals. There might even be some kind of interface that you can interact with. So yes. I'm trying to think of ways I can create an experience that helps make that connection between the visitors to, you know, whatever this exhibition might be and the lakes.
That's brilliant. David, I really do appreciate coming on the show. It's always also been an absolute pleasure meeting you at the Lake Shift and then seeing you again today. But I do wish you also the best of luck with whatever, with your PhD and whatever happens after that as well, because I think you've got lots to offer us.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure getting to know you as well. And thank you for the opportunity today to speak about my research.
No worries at all. And of course, as I say to everyone, that's it for another week of Grad Chat, which sadly comes to an end. So don't forget, you can download this show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcast. Just type in Grad Chat. Until next week, this is CJ the DJ signing off with a big hooray.
Grad Chat.
C-F-R-C.
101.9.
FM.
Cego.
Buju. Anim.
Danach A. Ak anzeni shuk with an.
Tante.
Oi, inuradike.
This is Words and Culture, a series on Indigenous languages, funded by SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.
Tanse, and welcome to Words and Culture. I'm your Cree host, Michael Hutchinson. Today we're off to my people's home area, Missipawistic, or Grand Rapids, Manitoba, as it's known in English. Missipawistic is two words put together that mean big rapids. Missi, meaning big, and Pawistic, meaning rapids. I'm going to take you to visit my auntie, Stella Neff, who is a language keeper and a knowledge keeper, and is an elder in my community and beyond. She's going to bake us some bannock with her chapan, her great-grandchild, and explain to us about the meaning of that Cree word, chapan. Stella is my second cousin, but in Cree culture, where extended family means a lot, she is my auntie. Before we set out for Missipawistic, Words and Culture producer Kim Wheeler and I headed out for some provisions.
What were you instructed to pick up, Michael?
I was instructed to pick up baking supplies for bannock. So flour and raisins and I guess baking powder?
Baking powder, yes. Okay, I heard that baking powder is a really important ingredient and people have They're specific about their baking powder.
Are they? I'm not certain if my auntie's that way because she wasn't very specific about the flour because back in the old days, my grandma would only use Robin Hood flour.
Raisins.
Thompson raisins. We're going to Grand Rapids, which is on the way to Thompson, so Thompson raisins sounds like a good plan.
Okay, controversial putting raisins in bannock, I'm sure.
Yes, well, it's almost like pineapple and pizza, but we're going to go for it.
Okay, and we're headed off to?
Grand Rapids, Missipawistic in Cree. Before we get into my Auntie Stella's home, I just want to give the listeners a trigger warning. We do talk about the traumas of residential school.
Hi.
Tansi.
Kinamaga.
We had dope.
Ah.
I was just mopping up my floor.
This is Kim.
Hi, Kim.
This is my Auntie Stella.
Hi.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Good.
Here. Good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you.
I got your flour and raisins.
Good.
How are you doing?
Oh, it smells so good in here already.
Oh, I had... old bananas I have to use up this morning. Actually, they've been on the counter since Tuesday.
So they were kind of black?
They were kind of getting black. Right. And then Tuesday I got, rabbits. So I had to skin those. And then I got chickens the day after. And then I got goose yesterday. So banana bread was last on the list.
Well, that sounds great. Goose, rabbit, and chickens.
Yeah.
Awesome.
And then Kevin dropped off sturgeon, which was the best.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Kevin's my brother.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, sit down. Let's talk about...
On this brisk winter's day, my Auntie Stella has one of her great-granddaughters with her, Jetta. She's almost a teenager, and they are making bannock together. Well, Jetta is making bannock, and Auntie Stella is supervising.
Go wash your hands, yeah. Go wash your hands first. Yeah, she's been making bannock every day.
Mm.
So And after the first day, I said, "Boy, you're good." I said, "I didn't help her in any way." And she says, "Well, remember, Coco, I won first prize 2 years ago when I was 9 years old at our Christmas party." Okay. We usually have a bannock bake-off with the kids.
Oh.
And she won. I said, "I forgot about that."
So you won a bannock making contest, I heard.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
There was a Christmas party. Part of our family. All of us went there. And then before we had like the party, we had a bannock bake-off thing. And that was the first time I ever made bannock on my own, because before that I was making bannock with my mom and mama. And that wasn't the first time ever I made bannock by myself. And I won first place.
Against your cousins.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Jetta is learning Cree in school, and I asked her what are some of the things that she's learning to say in Cree.
Animals and some words, and we're learning how to write in syllabics.
Oh, okay. So she's your chapan. Can you tell us a little bit about the word chapan?
It actually means you know, when you say chapan, it means yotapian, which means I'm pulling. Like when you're pulling somebody in a sled, yotapian anima, that's what you call yotapian. Well, that's what chapan, that's where the word comes from. So I'm pulling the past for her. And her, she's a chapan, so she pulls that into the future. That's what chapan means. Yotapian. Put some flour on it, a little bit for you. That's where the word chapan comes from. Yeah. It's the word otapian, that I'm pulling the past for her. And she pulls it into the future. It's the same word. She calls me chapan and I call her chapan. And it doesn't... it's in between, like you have your mom and dad, and then the Musum Nuhukum, and then the Nuhukum, the Musum, and then the Chapan, and then over here is Nitanis, Negusis, and the Chapan. So the seven words are on either side, the Chapan. The old lady is a Chapan, and the youngest one is a Chapan.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Have the rest for
10 minutes? Yeah. We need more flour on there, yeah.
So can you tell us a little bit about, you know, how did you learn Cree?
Well, in Grand Rapids, 70 years ago, everybody spoke Cree. There's no such thing. The only English-speaking people here were the teachers, maybe the store, not even the store manager, because Mrs. Campbell spoke Cree. The only other one was the priest or the minister, the Anglican minister and the priest, those are the only ones that spoke English. So everybody spoke Cree. Everybody. It's this Manitoba Hydro coming into town with 2,000 people and making a bigger school. It's in my generation we've lost the language, because we were strapped when we got to school. Like, I was strapped every day just because I spoke Cree. Because when you only know a language, that's all you use, you don't know that these people are not talking your language. And I got strapped every day. And then I'm the oldest, so my parents said, "Don't speak Cree to your brothers and sisters anymore, because we don't want them hit when they get to school." So that's how we started. The little English we learned, we spoke to all the younger ones. And then so it's right in the middle there, like Herbie, Cameron, Ellen, Richard, Ronnie, they all spoke Cree, and all the rest they speak, they didn't learn Cree because of that. Just because of that, they didn't. My parents didn't want them hit when they got to school, so. And then they get mad at us, like Michael and Donald and Dunstan and Joanne, and get mad at us because, why did you listen? Why did you listen and speak to us Cree? I said, we wanted to protect you too, so you don't get hit when you get to school. So that's what happened. They didn't learn the language. But I would say Michael now is in the PAW, so he's learning language because he drives bus for the elderly at the McGilver Care Home. So he's learning Cree, and then Joanne was learning Cree because she's working as a nurse. So it's just my generation. We lost it because of that, because of the policies of the government to kill the language in the child. It was happened under. It's not just a residential school. It happened here in the school because we were strapped, and we didn't learn the language. I mean, we didn't speak the language anymore because of those 200 kids that started school and they're speaking English and dressing in white people's clothes, and they used to make fun of us that they're dressed, smelled smoky. Well, of course we smelled smoky. We had wood stoves. Yeah, it was a destructive force, that hydro. This was the last house. Over there was the other house. All of this was bush. There was no highway because we didn't have vehicles. We didn't have vehicles in my lifetime. We had no noisy vehicles like cars or trucks or anything. We had the river was our highway, and we had the boats, and then the dog teams is what we used. My dad had, everybody had dog teams. And so we didn't really need these big roads, big highways, because we didn't have vehicles. It's only when Manitoba Hydro built this Highway 6 is only made in 1960. 1960s, I guess, they started building Highway 6, and they only built it as far as here. The one to Thompson was built later on in 1970, I think. Because people were in the way over there with Manitoba Hydro, they moved them over here. They expropriated the land from... Remember, they used to live by the Anglican Church? No, a Catholic Church. Oh, hell. Mecordies, both Mecordies. These are Mecordies. That's Mecordies. And they lived by the church. Well, they took them away from there because they built the forestry there. So they moved them over here. They made them move over here. They put them there. And then they got so upset because they bulldozed their houses. They were beautiful log buildings. And they just bulldozed them down because they wanted them to move over here because they were in the way. They were in the way for their construction. A lot of people, they did that to a lot of people. Like where the bridge is, they had a house across there. Norman Chief lived across there. On this side, the Prantos lived there. And then the Prantos were probably Métis. But then they just expropriated that land. They just told them to move. And then they didn't want to move anywhere else. And they moved to Winnipeg. And there was a family of five boys. And within a few years, all five had been killed in Winnipeg. And violently, those ones, Walter and Wilfred and John and Harry. There was five boys. They were all killed violently in Winnipeg because they were forced to leave Grand Rapids. I get so upset because there was no consideration for them that they, well, maybe you do want to live over here. No, it's just so you live over here, and that was it. And they didn't want to live here.
Can you tell us a little bit about the rapids, you know, and a lot, you know, that the ancestors what the people used to say about the rapids before, and then what happened when they went silent?
Well, like I said, the river was our highway, and in the summer, that's how we traveled. There was actually a tramway there, the original tramway from the 1800s, and you could go up there to the top of the rapids, because the rapids is built like this, and then we're here, and then we'd walk up there, and then my dad would take the boat up, and then we'd meet him over there and go further up into the river system, because it's not just Grand Rapids. There was five rapids between here and Chemowawin, which is Easterville. The original home of Easterville is Chemowawin. And we traveled up there, and that's where the hunting was done, that's where the berry picking was done, and that's where all the other life was done, hunting for trapping and fishing was this way, because the lake was too big and too dangerous for us when we didn't have any big boats. We just had little boats. We didn't have great big, like over there, that big yawl. And that's where we traveled. And it was when they closed that dam, we lost all that way of life. We lost where my dad used to hunt rabbit, and moose, and we lost all the things we used to pick berries or medicine or whatever they did before, because it was all flooded. And that's the boreal forest that was flooded. If you look this way now, it's all muskeg. There are so many things that I miss from that lifestyle, because we used to have, when I came back home, like I've been home 23 years now, I missed so many birds. I missed so many animals, like porcupine. Well, I haven't seen a porcupine in 50 years because the boreal forest is gone, because that's where they live. They like eating the aspen and the leaf trees. And
as we sit and visit on this Saturday afternoon, Jetta continues to make bannock. She comes in and out of the kitchen, so I asked her if she could count to 10 for me. She did, with a little help from her chapin.
Piak. So repeat after me.
Piak.
Niso.
Niso.
Nisto.
Nisto.
Neo.
Neo.
Nianan.
Niana.
Negutosik.
Negutosik.
Tepegup.
Tepegup.
Enaneo.
Kenanyo.
That's mitatast.
Miswadatata.
Mitatast, yeah.
Matata?
Yeah. That's 10.
When Jetta leaves the kitchen to return to watching TV, it doesn't take Auntie Stella long to turn back to the history of Missipuistic.
In my lifetime, I've seen the destruction of this culture, because in my lifetime, from birth to death, we looked after each other. We had midwives here. We didn't have to run over to the Paw and run off to Winnipeg or run off to Ashburn to have babies. We had midwives.
Well, you kind of talked about the land and the changes here. Like, you know, when I asked my mom, why didn't you teach me Cree?
Yeah.
She said, if you had a bush accent, you'd never be able to get a job.
Yeah, exactly.
So what are your thoughts on that?
That's exactly it. It's exactly it, the way that we were treated if you spoke Cree. It's the whole system, like we even being in school, being hit in school because you talk Cree. They didn't want anybody to speak Cree. And now they want everybody to speak Cree. And there's pathetic teachers, people that don't know the language, how to teach Cree. I said, it's so late. Because when I sit and talk to people, a lot of the times they don't understand anymore. They don't understand the language. They don't understand those deeper words, a deeper meaning that explain our culture. It's really sad that we've lost our language so much. When you think of even names of birds, when I think of my godfather in Easterville, Arthur Ballantyne. I visited him. His birthday was in April, and I visited him, and he'd say, Asay na watagupano, and name all these birds, the ones that have already arrived, the ones that he's been waiting for. And he named them all the little birds that would come in the spring, eh? And I'm sitting there listening, oh, I haven't heard that, I should write that down. But I didn't want to have paper to write it down. I'll remember when I get to the car. I get to the car, I forget. I'm so sorry I didn't go back and ask him, because we named everything. We don't use... We didn't use crow or magpie or all these words that we use now, because we named absolutely everything in this world. We didn't need English to rely on. And we do that so much. We rely so much on English for people. They use, when they're talking, they say skulik at the school. Instead, nikarim. Instead of tapanask, they say, for school, they say skulik. They use so much English size.
So it's bastardized words, yeah, to kind of add a little, yeah, bit of Cree just to the end,
yeah,
of it.
Yeah, just to put the beginning at the end, yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, there's, like, people are learning Cree, but it's sort of a surface Cree.
Cree is not the deep Cree. When they started university, I was so excited, because I admire deep thinkers. I admire intelligence. And when I was in university, I just loved things like psychology, philosophy, sociology, because it goes into the deeper, and then mythology. And then when they started talking about university, I thought, University College of the North, oh my goodness, it'll be so exciting, because they'll teach these courses, they'll teach about our stories that we have. And I said, and we could write them down and record them, because in there is what we really believe about the world.
As our visit comes to a close, Jetta comes back to check in on the Bannock.
What, is it ready? Is it?
It looks a little white still.
Let's see. We'll turn that light on. Wastepita, I should say. I'll check it.
How do you say it's done?
I say.
It looks good.
Yep, it does. Okay, turn it off. Okay. Looks good. Flip it over so it won't get wet. Amazing.
Nice and golden.
Yeah, it's nice and golden, yeah.
So how do you feel about her learning Cree in school now then?
Well, it's better than... I'm disappointed. Like, they've been teaching 7 years while they're still just doing animals and verbs. We should be learning things like some of the words that are more meaningful, because it's so basic still, like Minugisiga, well, of course, nice day, and Utaksikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikikik I get really disappointed in how little is being taught in Cree, because our speakers are dying. That's the sad thing.
I wanted to know more about this idea of a deeper Cree, so I asked Auntie Stella to teach me some.
The one thing we were always taught about is Ushchene.
Ushchene.
Ushchene. It's a result of something that you have done that is not right, and it's sort of like punishment for not doing right. Like if you torture animals, surely you will also sometimes suffer, someday suffer because of it.
Ushchene.
Ushchene, yeah.
It almost sounds a little bit like karma.
It is. It is. But I don't know the full meaning of what karma is, because it's...
From a different culture.
Yeah,
but.
Yeah, it's a different culture. And, but it's very, very... it was taught a lot to us not to do things that will cause us to have ostinae. And that's one thing that we don't teach our children.
I remember hearing a story when I was young about a girl who teased another girl.
Yeah.
And then that first girl's baby was born with the blemish that she teased that other girl about.
Yeah. Yeah, that's ostinae. Yeah.
So yeah. What you put out in the universe,
yeah,
will come back to you.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other one that I really believe in, and I really think is being lost when you say, is amatiso. Amatiso.
Amatiso.
Yeah. It's when you receive a sign to be wary, because something is going to happen to you.
Now, there's not really a word for goodbye in Cree, but we use ekose. As we head off on our five-hour drive back to Winnipeg, my Auntie Stella has given me a lot to think about. I turn the car onto Highway 6 and listen to another Missipawistic citizen, Matthew Cook Contois. He's a master fiddle player as well as a singer-songwriter. This is his band Eagle Ex Machina and Verbal Thoroughfare. We'll see you next time on Words and Culture. Be well, stay smiling.
Find the words to calm me down with.
Words and Culture is made possible with funding from SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Words and Culture is produced by Kim Wheeler. Kaylin Belair is our audio engineer and editor.
Onigiwahi.
Gigawabamin. Soko seni denit e ninen yuji hina.
Eko se.
Kakuhutau. We'll see you again.
CFRC 101.9 FM is so thrilled to announce the launch of our brand new accessible website at cfrc.ca. Get your local news, stream your favorite shows, and stay up to date with upcoming events. You can share news tips, book a recording studio, request a PSA for airplay, and oh so much more. CFRC.ca was made possible through the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada and our amazing